It's the judge's fault, right? You can't say that, but I can. I don't have any sympathy for any federal judge in America if lawyers start doing the same in briefs.
Welcome to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. And now your hosts, Tim Kowal and Jeff Lewis.
Welcome, everyone. I am Jeff Lewis.
And I'm Tim Kowal, California Department of Podcasting License Pending Review. In each episode of the California Appellate Law Podcast, we provide trial attorneys with legal analysis and practice tips from an appellate perspective. Both Jeff and I are appellate specialists who split our practices evenly between trial and appellate courts. And on this podcast, we try to give our listeners some perspective in their trial court matters and on appeal.
All right, everyone. Welcome to episode 33 of the podcast.
And today we are very honored to welcome Ross Guberman to the show. Ross Guberman is the president of Legal Writing Pro, LLC, and the founder of Briefcatch, LLC. Ross has conducted thousands of workshops on three continents for prominent law firms and judges. His workshops are among the highest rated in the world for professional legal education. Ross holds degrees from Yale, the Sorbonne, and the University of Chicago Law School. Ross's book, Point Made, How to Write Like the Nation's Top Advocates, is an Amazon bestseller. Ross also wrote Point Taken, How to Write Like the World's Greatest Judges, which Court Review called the best book by far about judicial writing. Ross's newest product, which we'll talk about today, Briefcatch, helps lawyers improve the writing quality of their briefs and was named one of TechnoLawyer's top 10 legal tech products of the year. And for the past 6 years, Ross has been invited to train all new federal judges, and he has presented at many other judicial conferences as well. So thank you for joining us, Ross, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm jealous of that Southern California sunshine coming through your windows.
Yeah, it's been nice. We've got some early summer weather coming. So we're very pleased to have you, Ross. As I mentioned, most of our audience is made up of trial attorneys and appellate attorneys. And a lot of us, particularly appellate attorneys, are really kind of honed in on legal writing, grammar issues, and things like that. And Jeff and I have recently been trying out your product Briefcatch and running all of our briefs feverishly through to see how we score according to your algorithms and what kind of suggestions it would make to improve our writing. So I wonder if you, before we launch into legal writing and your products, maybe we just learn a little bit about you. And I kind of named off all the braggy stuff in your resume. Maybe tell us a little bit who you are, Ross, and how you got into the law and got into being a legal writing guru.
Sure. So I sort of fell into law school, as many people do. I was actually doing a PhD in language, linguistics, and so forth. And I dropped out pretty quickly. It's one smart decision I made not to fester for too many years. So I dropped out after about a year and a half, got a master's, and then went to law school. And I actually did enjoy the law quite a bit. I enjoyed law school. I was at a big firm. I liked that too. So I was actually pretty much dead set on becoming a practicing lawyer for life. But then I ended up leaving the firm, as you can guess from my bio. And I ventured out to do various things, just sort of trying to find my way. And long story short,
why did you like practicing law?
Company. What's that?
Sorry to interrupt, but I was just curious. Why didn't you like practicing law?
I actually did like practicing law, and I still like being exposed to that world. I'm just sort of a restless person who's, you know, gets really excited about something and then I just run out of steam. It isn't like I disliked it in any way. I just thought maybe I would try something else, knowing that I could always go back to big law, as it's known. Got it. I think back then it was two words, big law. Now it's just one, according to above the law.
Yeah. Well, sorry to have interrupted. So then after you left big law, what was the next step in your path that led you into writing and speaking on legal writing?
I tried a bunch of things all at once. So I actually taught at the very first online university, which is still around, Strayer University. Had an interesting mix of prisoners and Iraq war soldiers and stay-at-home parents. So that was interesting. And I did some other types of teaching. I started teaching at GW Law School. I did a little bit in publishing, a little bit in journalism. And then I also had a business where I wrote and edited briefs, and especially appellate briefs for different firms. And that's actually how the training company got started.
Okay, great. Yeah. And, you know, when I was looking at your resume and saw that, you know, you'd started as a practicing attorney and then left. And I thought about, you know, I'm also someone who loves writing. And I sometimes wonder what it would be like to do it full time and not be belabored by actual, you know, remunerative activity. But, you know, as the writer and lawyer, John Mortimer related to his father, telling him that the great thing about the law is that it gets you out of the house. And I see you spend a lot of time giving workshops and seminars on legal writing. So you're still out and about, you know, you're not just holed up writing books and just, you know, you're not up. What made you decide that you would get out there and start teaching judges how to write their opinions?
I'm just smiling because, you know, on the Myers-Briggs, most lawyers are I for introvert, and I'm definitely a strong E. So everything you say, you know, makes sense in retrospect about definitely not being a monk. So training judges actually came quite a few years later, as you can guess. And you don't run out of the gate and start telling federal judges what to do. So I spent quite a few years mainly with law firms, but also CLEs, first state bars, and other organizations. And then, you know, just you have to have your first gig with judges. So mine was the Eighth Circuit. So I spoke at the Eighth Circuit conference. I remember Justice Alito was there. We all were on the same bus to Crazy Horse and Mount Rushmore. And that was my first venture into speaking to judges. So that was a judicial conference. As I said, those are a little more casual, a little more fun. And then shortly thereafter, I started being asked to do the you know, annual or every couple of years program for all the new federal judges.
Okay. So Ross, why is, in your opinion, why is good writing important? So in our world, we're kind of overtaken by talkers. Is good writing as important as it used to be? Is it more or less important?
Well, certainly in your neck of the woods, the appellate world, it's extremely important. I mean, I think I notice a lot of law schools come out of law school thinking that oral advocacy and writing are kind of tied in importance, which, you know, could be true, of course, in some practice areas, but certainly not if you talk to judges quietly. I mean, they love to say oral argument matters on panels, but most cases, as you know, are decided on the briefs. That's also true in the trial court. So it's certainly important in that regard. It's also, I think, a very good way to distinguish yourself from other lawyers. It's a fairly rare skill if you ask around. I mean, most lawyers, of course, are decent writers, competent writers, but you don't hear that many praised, you know, effusively for writing. So I think it's important for that reason as well. And then also because, at the end of the day, in the common law world, common law jurisdiction, that's what endures, right? It's not the kind of the cool biting quips people have in oral argument at the Supreme Court. Comes down to opinions and briefs. That's how you really make your mark. So they're my three reasons, kind of my, you know, like the teacher says, biology is the most important class in high school. That's what I would say about writing for lawyers and judges.
You mentioned a moment ago about, you know, about getting praise as a legal writer. How does a lawyer, a practitioner, go about getting praise as a legal writer? So I was going to ask you something similar later on about the difference between writing as a practitioner and writing as a judge. And I wonder if you are writing in such a way as to be conspicuous. I wonder sometimes if you're doing something wrong. Like I've heard writing advice that here's what to do after you finish writing your brief, how to edit it. Find the line in there that you like the best and take it out.
Yeah, that's the old kill your darlings advice in writing, which is, you know, kind of depressing as advice goes, even if it's on point. So it's actually a very interesting question you ask, because I think sometimes people get cues about what makes them garner praise, and it may not necessarily lead them down the safest or most enjoyable path. So basically there are two ways you'll see judges and lawyers alike you get attention or even praise. So the first would be kind of the quip, you know, the quip, the funny kind of Twitter ready sentence or line, usually sarcastic, sometimes witty. And for better or for worse, whether people in theory think it's good to praise that stuff or not, that tends to get attention. You know, you something that's a little barb, a little bit personal, a little bit clever. You will certainly, on both sides, lawyer or judge, get attention and even praise for that. So that's sort of the conspicuous way of getting praise. And again, that's the social, that's the sort of social media path. If you look at what gets Twitter, Twitter quoted or LinkedIn quoted, it's not case analysis, right? It's usually some clever quip.
Right.
So the other way is not quite as exciting in the short run. Like, you don't get immediate attention. It's quieter, but it's probably more effective. And that is just trying to rise above the fray somehow, just in the day-to-day sentence creation that any lawyer or judge has, right? All day long, most sentences, even Justice Scalia's dissents, most sentences were in no way, shape, or form witty or clever. And in those more, again, more quiet moments, more routine moments, you rise above the fray by being especially clear, especially flowing, especially concise relative to your peers. And it's not easy. It's not easy because, of course, you have to do all that within the confines of the subject matter. And also in a profession where you have lots of different types of demanding and critical readers.
So Ross, you are busy writing books, you're teaching seminars about writing, you're producing legal writing software. What parts about all these activities that you're doing energize you, and what parts are a little bit more draining? You talked about being an extrovert and an introvert, and I can tell you, as I'm hosting a podcast, but I'm an introvert. So activities like this can be a drain on me. It's fun, but it's a drain. And so I wonder, for you, what's invigorating and what's draining?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how that changes, of course, as you grow up in age. So certainly right now, without any hesitation, I'd say everything associated with legal tech is energizing and exciting. For some of that's obvious, as you said, I'm in the business myself, but it's not all just that. I mean, it's not just my own stake or my own experience. I definitely feel like the profession, which is very often downbeat, I think we're in a particularly negative period. Almost everything you see written about our profession these days is negative. Except with this one exception, there's a lot of excitement, a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, innovation around tech. So, just a couple months ago, I went to, it was actually a live conference, believe it or not, in New York, big legal tech conference. And just to compare the mood there to the mood of other legal conferences I go to, it's just really, really startling just to kind of see and feel and soak up all the energy. So there's that, plus I do like business, right? I ended up creating not particularly complicated training business, but it was a business. So that's still energizing for me, even though I've transferred all that to software sales. Draining, I really do. I know people say this and it sounds suspicious. I do basically love my job as much as I ever have. But to answer your question, the one thing that's probably not as fun as it used to be very blunt, I would be doing seminars in law firms just because, and I'm not talking about COVID, that would be too obvious a point. Even before COVID, you just see, as the generations change, less and less appetite for kind of sitting still for 2 or 3 hours and soaking up learning. So that's just not quite as enticing or energizing, to use your word, it was 10 years ago.
And just to follow up on what you said about legal tech as being kind of an exciting new world these days, does that have to do more with the advances in the legal tech, or does it have to do with maybe younger attorneys coming up being more receptive to using legal tech, or some of both?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on both fronts. So, for as much as people like to criticize the younger generation, this is a wonderful strength that they have, and it's infectious, especially if you're getting older as I am. So there's a lot of that. I mean, this is the future of the profession. It's not really a choice at this point, right? So people want to kind of stave it off, delay it, but it is the future. And as you said, I think the younger generation of lawyers and law students, they're in great shape to exploit it. But your other point is also very, very well taken. There are all sorts of advances that make it easier, I think, for lawyers to focus on what value they can really add and avoid a lot of the other tasks. And then also, we talk a lot about access to justice and inequities and the like. And a lot of this tech, although, to be honest, and I'm no exception, a lot of it ends up being marketed to huge law firms and the like. But the truth is, a lot of it really, if used properly, can make getting legal advice and legal services much more reasonable and much more efficient for many clients and would-be clients. So I think that's exciting as well.
All right. Well, Jeff, did you want to jump in there with a question?
Well, I did have one question. I think I know the answer. We're going to get to it next, but let me just ask you, you know, COVID-19 gave us the gift of time in terms of not going to court, not going to seminars, lots of free time. Tim and I used that time to kind of birth this podcast. One of my favorite authors, Brandon Sanderson, used the time to draft 5 novels that he didn't tell anybody about. Oh. What did you use your time during COVID and the shutdown and not going to seminars? Was there any pet projects or things that you were able to accomplish?
Well, I would have liked to turn out 1 novel. Forget 5, but I turned out 0 novels. So little bit envious to hear that someone managed 5. So yeah, it was certainly it was an interesting time for me just because of the really dramatic change, you know, right overnight. Someone who's on the road all the time, meeting different groups, sometimes 4 or 5 cities, then instantly, as was the case for most of us, trapped in my house for much longer than I had imagined. So for me, it was mostly a positive experience with my family, certainly kids home from college and the like. So that part was really positive. But professionally, I was able to really, really focus on Brief Catch and really, really dig in to some of the nuances and to really make progress on some of the goals I had without the hustle and bustle of running through airports and, you know, checking in and out of hotels. So it was a new experience for me to be kind of calm and kind of quiet and to, you know, be in my house, not seeing a lot of people live. But yeah, Overall, especially relative to a lot of the struggles other people had, I'd say I was pretty, pretty blessed.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, you know, I've attended your seminars, and regardless of your view of it being draining, it was fantastic for me. I've read your books, but for years, I've been like the guy on the outside, you know, looking at a window, looking in, because my firm is all Mac, and I have not been able to use your Brief Catch software, which has been around for a while. And you just recently announced the release of Brief Catch 3.0. Why don't you tell us what the software is and how it can help?
Yeah, great. Yeah, the Mac compatibility is exciting, obviously, for me as well. So glad to hear it. So as the years went on with the books and other things I've written, and especially the seminars, people would, you know, judges and lawyers alike would say, you know, this is all great, it's fantastic. The last 2-3 hours, good stuff, but how the heck, or sometimes they'd say hell, how the hell would, is anyone supposed to remember all this? Is there any way to automate it? Or, you know, before the word automation was trendy, I think people would say, is there any way to make a macro or something like that? So, you know, I heard it enough times that I finally got the message, and I dipped my toe into the world of legal tech. So it was a little over 4 years ago that the first version of Brief Catch was launched. And as you said, we just launched the third version. But basically what it does is it takes a draft at any stage, including early on, any section of a draft. And at this point, we have about 11,000 ways to improve the draft or fix common errors, everything from blue booking to just, you know, savings clause instead of saving clause. That's one of the newer rules a judge suggested I include. And it does all that incredibly fast, especially this new version, just seconds, 11,000 rules. And it will either give you a just kind of a fix, right? It'll correct something you either accepted or rejected, or as you've probably seen many times, it will give you a choice of options. And then fairly new in the last year or so, I have lots of explanations and also lots of examples. So kind of everything, a lot of the things people frankly paid a lot of money for in those workshops are now readily available to our users as they're doing their work. So they don't have to go to a 6-hour CLE in a hotel or at a firm. It's sort of on the job.
Yeah, I have to say, one of the features I enjoy the most is that examples. It's not just, hey, would you rephrase your sentence here? It is, hey, do you want to write like Scalia or Alito? And you have little examples underneath the box. It's really super interesting.
It's fun. I mean, I don't have to apologize for saying these things are fun, right? It's my profession, but it really is fun choosing the examples. And as you said, it can also be ammunition when you get into arguments with colleagues, because now they're arguing not with you, but with Scalia, Kagan, and the like.
That makes it fun for the user.
You know, at the risk of offending our audience, I'm going to go out and say, you know, the Yellow Book, the California Style Manual, is, you know, superior to the Blue Book. Your software, when it's evaluating citations and those kinds of things, is it directed towards Blue Book or Yellow Book, or is there a way to modify that?
I mean, it's directed toward the errors that most lawyers most of the time worry about. So, you know, extra spaces and reporter names and so forth. But I generally do stick to the Blue Book. When I do have some things particular for California lawyers, also for Texas, a couple of things for particular trial courts, even Canadian citations. You know, hopefully all this will soon be a moot point as we move to hyperlinking in the cleaned up movement. But yeah, for the most part, I try to focus on the things that seem to torment the most lawyers
What is the cleaned up movement? And why don't you share with Tim in particular what that's about?
You mean sell?
That's right. I read between the lines. Maybe you have a nice friendly argument over this. So cleaned up it's actually an interesting phenomenon separate and apart from the merits, because it's a rare time there's been really any reform in the profession, you know, that happened fairly quickly. So cleaned up is something dreamed up by an attorney here in Washington. And he was trying to do something about the whole blue booking apparatus that people tend not to like multiple reporters and having to have, you know, citations omitted and quotations omitted and bracketing things that you lowercase. So the idea was you'd get rid of a lot of that junk. And then in exchange for that, at the end of the citation in parentheses, you'd put cleaned up. So it's taken off. I remember Justice Thomas did it, and that was kind of news. Another justice did it shortly thereafter. But when I say that the reform has taken off, as with every single thing in this profession, 24 hours a day, it's still controversial. And there are also people who hate it. Right? I've heard three camps. I love it, I hate it, or I've never heard of it. It's still a fairly large group. So yeah, we'll see. I mean, the anti-case that I've heard is actually, I think, valuable to consider. And it's that, you know, things that sound really obsessive compulsive, like bracketing, lowercasing, and capitalizing, actually are not. So if you're quoting from an opinion and it looks like you're quoting the whole sentence, but you're really not, that's something a lot of courts want to know. They want to see the bracket to see that it wasn't actually the beginning of a sentence.
Interesting. I've heard a fourth camp that sometimes, you know, some people say it's okay for judges to use cleaned up because they're a trusted judge would never miscite a case. But for parties, on the other hand, or lawyers representing parties, it's a risky move to do cleaned up.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm generally concerned about that just because I think judges do send cues to litigators and appellate advocates through their opinions. So if, you know, they can't have it both ways, right? They can't do it and then say they object to it in briefs. I mean, they shouldn't think that's going to work. Although intellectually, I see the point. I mean, a lot of judges do get reversed, right? So I'm not sure they're all as pure and perfect as I know you have to say publicly. But yeah, there's something to that. I suppose there's something to that, right? That you're less likely, just given the clerks and the kind of the apparatus in the courthouse, you're less likely to really miscite a case, perhaps, if you're a judge.
Let's just jump back to Briefcatch for a moment. I wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about, Ross, you told us about what's under the hood. There's 11,000 rules programmed into it that the software is looking for and checking your legal writing against. And legal writing, you're not going to catch my ending that sentence in a preposition, because that was just extemporaneous and exempt from the rules. But the different kinds of metrics that Briefcatch is looking for are reader engagement, whether the brief is concise and readable, whether it's flowing and cohesive, whether it's crisp and punchy, and whether it's clear and direct. And since I installed the software, Ross, I've been madly running, you know, all of my past briefs through it to see how I stack up on those. And most of them, you know, are fairly consistent. I think one that I noticed bounces around quite a bit is on flowing and cohesive for me. And you know, on you know, one brief, I think I hit 100, and on others, I'm down in like the 60s. And it made me think about something Tocqueville had said about writing, and that writing is an act of discovery. And sometimes, particularly if you're the appellant and you're still kind of feeling your way around the arguments, how do I get from this point to that point? And you're just kind of writing, and you might get there, but it might not always be a straight line. And so that might make me pay on the flowing and cohesive score. And so that's where really you know, if I had endless amounts of time and hours to put into it, I could make that road a little bit straighter. But I wonder if you have any tips for me and our audience about how to, you know, best ways to make a brief more flowing and cohesive.
Sure. So just one quick note is, I think this is novel, that the scores are based on empirical evidence. In other words, I didn't just make up what I think matters. I actually took a huge universe of briefs and opinions and other legal documents written by superstars. And everything that goes into those five scores is somehow related to whatever I've seen through AI is more, you know, more or less common in that lofty group. So that's how the scores are derived. So for flowing and cohesive, three things. And you know, you don't want to take the scores too seriously, of course, but these are three things that seem to matter, again, if you look at the top-notch writer's work. So one is having a lot of transitions that have logical value. So in other words, not furthermore, not additionally, not moreover, those are just, I'm going to keep talking, I'm going to keep writing transition words. But ones like even so, or that said, or from that perspective, or in fact, anything that shows that you're trying to think through the law or sometimes even the facts. So that's going to, you know, that's going to up the score, because that's something you'll notice in a lot of the great legal and judicial writers' work. So that's the first. So the second is different types of numbering, right? So again, going back to the furthermore, further, additionally habit, it's not that you necessarily get a higher or lower score if you have first, second, third, but anything that looks like you're trying to present 2, 3, 4, 5 things in parallel form that's easy to follow and not just stringing them together with furthermore. And then the third is, again, this is all empirical. That's, you know, started in my books that I noticed these things. So it's a sign that you're trying to make your sentences and paragraphs flowing by linking the end of one sentence or paragraph to the beginning of the next. So if you have, you know, if you're talking about a statute and then the next sentence starts with the administrative agency that's, you know, subject to the statute, and at the very end of the next sentence, you then finally mention, oh, I'm still talking about the statute. That's not going to get as many points as that statute, you know, passed 5 years ago, has been applied by this court 7 times. Anything that links 2 sentences, links 2 paragraphs is going to up that score, because again, that's something much more common in a lot of the best writers' work.
And you say, don't take the scores too seriously. You know, I have a crack associate.
People do take them seriously, though.
Yeah. I've got a crack associate in my firm. I run his briefs through there. They're consistently in the 90s. Okay. He's a superstar. Maybe as a supervising attorney or as a law firm, what should we do with those scores if we're not to take them seriously? What do you recommend?
Well, I'm saying, you know, it's like the disclaimer, like, don't use this, you know, don't use this jackknife, you know, when you're drunk. It's that kind of thing. I mean, of course, I'm going to say don't take them seriously. Of course, people are going to take them seriously. Doesn't matter what I say. A lot of famous people write me to like appeal their scores as if they really matter, which is pretty funny. So, the you know, in an ideal world, the point of the scores would be self-improvement, right? So if you would just be trying overall without overly fixating to get them higher and higher. Another thing that I think people miss is, instead of thinking about the scores and how high they are, maybe try to figure out why you have a high score and try to make it something you can remember and do again, right? So there's a lot of people think if you just read great writing, you'll become a great writer. If it were that easy, we'd have a profession of fantastic writers. I mean, they could just read, you know, a Scalia dissent every day and they'd all write like Justice Scalia or Justice Kagan. So what really matters is not reading great writing. Again, that would make it too easy. It's really understanding the nuts and bolts and being able to replicate them. So there's something to that too. You know, sometimes our profession focuses too much on criticizing and correcting, not nearly enough on identifying what's really successful and giving people tools to replicate it.
All right, Ross, I wanted to talk about a little bit about your book, Point Made, because you had told us that that brief catch was really an outgrowth of what you wrote about in your books and talk about in your seminars. So I think maybe in a manner of speaking, we can get under the hood by talking about some of the points in Point Made, where you advise attorneys One piece of advice, I don't know that this could be translated into something like a brief catch, but I love this, where you advise attorneys to tap into three key fears that all judges have. And they are fear of misconstruing a doctrine or statute, fear of creating new duties, rules, or defenses, and fear of reaching an unfair result or causing harm. And when I read that, I thought that's great to keep in mind, but I wondered where you got that list and are there more fears that we can tap into?
Yeah, these days, a lot of people are afraid of a lot of things about the future, I suppose. So one thing for my whole career has been empiricism, and that's unfortunately generally lacking in the profession. So in other words, even when I wrote the book, which is a long time ago, I think it came out first edition in 2011, my idea was always, who cares what I think? Doesn't matter what I think. You want to look at the top performers as you would in any healthier profession. You'd look at the top performers and try to figure out what they do. So what I noticed in my study of motions and briefs from stars is that in the introduction, although they had the same balancing test and the same introduction of the parties everybody else does, they seem to have a way of figuring out what was going to hold the court back from doing what the client wanted, and they would preempt it somewhere in the introduction by appealing to one of those concerns, right? So they have a sixth sense, if you will, though there's nothing magical here. They have a sixth sense of what really happens when judges have these cases, and they're able to sort of help kind of predict what's going to be bothersome and try to put it to rest.
What else do you get from judges about what, you know, their thought process in absorbing lawyer briefs and developing their opinions about the case? What kind of things impress them about the briefs and might, you know, might turn the tide, so to speak, in your writing and you know, achieve persuasion?
So a couple things come up a lot. One is early on, in a at least somewhat fair way, juxtaposing the two main parties' views without simply saying that the other party is, you know, insane or out to lunch or completely wrong. So really presenting what the whole fight, think about it as like wrestling. What does it really come down to? What are the parties really arguing over without necessarily treating it as a harmless error or as an application of a four-part injunctive relief standard? What are they really fighting over? And not trying to hide what your opponent is going to say, because the judge is going to figure it out anyway. And it's just much more helpful to have it up front, so it seems like an actual dispute. So that's one. And then another is probably related, because it's a show of confidence. And that is admitting that a couple of facts don't go your way. And also admitting when you discuss case law that no case is truly, no important case, at least. If you're talking for a paragraph or more about a case, there's almost a 0% chance that it is perfect for you, right? So that's something that people forget. If it takes that long to say that a case is directly on point, it's not directly on point. And that's fine. That's part of the common law system. So it's kind of candor, right? Just candor, saying, well, it's true that in that case, you know, the company, maybe it was an LLC and not an LLP. I'm just making something up, but not a big deal. Here's why. So in both the examples I gave you, the attorney understands that you project strength. You project strength by showing that you're not afraid of the complexity and the reality that nothing is perfect, right? It's rare that you have a true slam dunk, whether in the trial courts or on appeal.
Yeah. To that point about admitting facts that don't go your way, I've always wondered about, you know, and I think you also have an example in point made about this, about kind of, I'll call it sweeping bad facts under the rug using the leading adverb, although. You say, well, although this happened, you know, or, you know, even though this happened, is that, does that sound too defensive? Does that sound like whenever you see that kind of word, you know, does the judge jump up, pounce on it and say, aha, so this is what they're really scared of?
Not at all, right? First of all, the judge is going to know whether you say it or not. Second, you're going to end the sentence on why the although or even though point doesn't really matter. And that's the part people are going to remember. But third, what a lot of people do at both trial, you know, in trial briefs and appellate briefs is actually much more defensive, which is, you know, my opponent is attempting, you know, usually it's like valiantly attempting or endeavoring to imply that Smith, come on, it's just like, relax. That's what makes people defensive, right? Acting like it's like a conspiracy, but actually, no, the case is perfect, or the record is pristine, the client is an angel. That's what makes you defensive. Simply saying, here's something that doesn't go quite the right way, or the client isn't perfect, or the opponent isn't all bad, but it doesn't really matter, and here's why. That actually is very close to the same process the court's going to have to go through, right? Again, very few cases truly go 100% in one party's favor.
I had another question that maybe in the same vein as our discussion about cleaned up, and the subject is about informality in legal writing. And I think there's a general trend that says it's a good thing because it helps make your writing more direct and approachable. There's more engagement. But I wonder if practitioners should take a different view than what they might be getting out of judicial opinions. Some judicial opinions, Jeff and I have talked about, they're quoting, you know, making pop culture references, and sometimes they have tweet-worthy lines in them. And I wonder if you would advise lawyers to go ahead and mimic that, or maybe stay away from some of those kinds of particularly.
Right. I mean, you had an interesting and to me surprising controversy out there in the Ninth Circuit with Judge Lee, who had a couple of Hamilton references and a reference to The Bachelor, and I think a Matthew McConaughey line in an opinion. I think it was about class actions. And you would have thought the world had come to an end if you listened to America's law professors. So it's actually really complicated. What does informality mean? What do people want? Where do you draw the line? I don't know if it really is just about terminology, but I would say, even if I said to you, hey, so-and-so has informal writing, you and I might not be thinking of the same things, right? Any two lawyers, any two judges, you might not even know if that's a compliment or an insult to say someone has informal writing. So again, I put these things into two camps, and it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning. You have the kinds of things that are on Twitter, like a judge made a joke about The Bachelor, right? That's like a one-off attempt to be informal and engaging. And it works sometimes, it doesn't work other times. Frankly, there's a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of ideological bias in both directions. People tend to like those things when they like the judge or like the opinion, and think that they're absolutely beyond the pale when they don't. So that's one kind of informality. I think that's what you're talking about. And it's the judge's fault, right? You can't say that, but I can. I don't have any sympathy for any federal judge in America if lawyers start doing the same in briefs, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't have all the little jokes and puns and also all this backstabbing and the concurrences and dissents, and then be appalled that lawyers do the same. The other type of informality actually takes talent, right? It takes actual skill. So I'll just use Justice Kagan as an example. So she has what one might call an informal prose style, but it's not really so much, although sometimes she has something about Dr. Seuss, you know, something a little bit corny and populist. Mainly it's just the choice of words and sentence structure, just closer to conversational writing and speech. That's the kind of informality almost everybody appreciates.
Got it. And are there still some judges who prefer a more formal style? And by formal, I'm talking about the second type that you talked about. Not so conversational. Maybe some judges would prefer something closer to the old traditional stodgy style of legal writing. Or is the modern trend toward conversational style pretty much overwhelming?
Well, one thing I noticed during lockdowns and COVID, especially since judges, whether they wanted to or not, almost uniformly ended up reading all the briefs on iPads and devices and not in hard copy. So one thing I've noticed is now it's almost universal that people want shorter, more modern writing, right? A little bit closer to what you're calling this informal style, just because they're just overwhelmed, and it's just much easier to process when you're reading things on devices. So there are things people do that are probably provocative, like having contractions or slang. I'm not sure for most lawyers those are worth the trouble, since some judges really hate those kinds of things. So you still want to exercise some discretion, so to speak. But in general, yes, I'd say things have changed in the courts and in briefs themselves. Closer to a more modern style. Doesn't mean people are producing it, but it does mean that's what readers want.
You offered another good point in Point Made about letting a way to let the air out of old cases that might be bad for you by emphasizing their age. And I've wondered if this, again, this distinction is always in my mind between things. I certainly see courts do this, but I always worry that if I try to do it and I say, oh, well, don't follow that case, it's really old, the court might have a different mind and say, oh, it's not old, it's venerable. Which way the
that's
the
right
going to fall on that?
Like a nice wine, right? Instead of just something in a garage sale. Yeah. Well, you know, it's always, I'm always a little perplexed. People often, when I praise something, people on Twitter jump to criticize it. And I think they often miss what the actual lawyer was facing, right? So in other words, if you had a great new case, you wouldn't have this problem. So when lawyers do this effectively, they don't really have a choice. There is a very old case and it goes against them. So the question is not, well, why are they making a big deal about it being old? The question is, what's the best way to get out of the mess? So there's probably a way to do it that backfires, right? I mean, as you said, I mean, especially in a common law system, old is sometimes good, not bad. But there are things you can emphasize. For a case that's been around 40 years, it's only appeared in 10 opinions. I mean, that kind of thing can be compelling. You can, without saying, hey, overturn it, you can talk about, you know, problems in the reasoning or how it might not really apply. So there are ways to handle it when, not if, but when you don't have a choice, right? Again, in a perfect world, all the cases would go our way, but that world doesn't really exist, right? So the question is, when these challenges arise, what is the most effective way to handle them?
Right. Okay. And then, you know, you offer in Point Made, I wanted to offer this for listeners that there's a great trick in Microsoft Word. And I think, I assume you put this in before the advent of Brief Catch, but if you don't have Brief Catch and you just wanted to check your writing and how the Microsoft algorithms rate it, you can go to File and look for Proofing, and there you'll find Show Readability Statistics, and it will give you your average words per sentence, your reading ease score, and the percentage of your sentences that are passive. And that'll just kind of give you a taste of, you know, I'm not sure how many rules are in there, but nowhere near the 11,000 that are under the hood in Brief Catch. But that might kind of wet your beak a little bit to see how algorithms might be pointing in your legal writing. And go ahead. I asked you earlier, you know, whether good writing is still important these days. And now that you've shared some of your insight about what makes for great legal writing, I wanted to ask you if you had a philosophy about writing in general. And I wanted to, and while you're thinking about it, I'll share one of my favorite quotes about writing. And it's from Samuel Johnson, who said, it is strange that there should be so little reading in the world and so much writing. People in general do not willingly read if they can have anything else to amuse them. There must be an external impulse, emulation or vanity or avarice. The progress which the understanding makes through a book has more pain than pleasure in it. Language is scanty and inadequate to express the nice gradations and mixtures of our feelings. No man reads a book of science from pure inclination. And I would add to that probably no one is reading a legal brief from pure inclination either. So my question from that is, should attorneys try to make legal briefs more than they are? Should an attorney strive to make their briefs more than just useful roadmaps, which is something useful for the court, or can they aspire to something like art in a legal brief, or should they leave that to the weekends?
Yeah, well, you know, Chief Justice Roberts, who I would think is not super easy to impress, he's said more than once that he has enjoyed reading briefs and actually wanted to learn more. I mean, I think there are people who manage to do that. I mean, Samuel Johnson lived in an austere era. There are fantastic science writers writing books and magazines in our day that, I mean, I'm not a science person, but I read those books for pleasure. So yeah, I wouldn't give up. I wouldn't set the bar too low. I don't think you're going to have a John Grisham motion in limine too easily. But if you think about, given that people have a task at hand, they have to decide a case, they have to decide a motion, and you're trying to make that task as pleasant as possible, there's a lot you can do. Not doesn't require any great creativity. There are a lot of little things you can do to make it more enjoyable. So if you go back to the science example, Samuel Johnson says it's impossible. Maybe it was then. You know, I had to read some of those books in graduate school back then, science books But nowadays, you'll see the same kind of thing, right? People will give you good examples, analogies. They'll have a lot of images of the planets and the moon. You know, they'll relate things to other things that you know or that you've heard, or they'll talk about scientific controversies and give you different views. It's not that different in emotion or brief or opinion, right? You try to be as helpful as you can and try to make people at least feel like they're understanding things as they go along. And that's enough to make a lot of readers really happy and grateful, just that they understand whatever it is you're asking them to understand. That's enough. That's enough to make them feel pretty darn good.
All right, Ross. So we've covered your product, Brief Catch, and your book, Point Made. Other than picking up these products of yours, what is something that you'd recommend to our listeners that would help them improve their writing?
I'd say pick a model. So pick some sort of writer in the profession, judge or lawyer, and commit to just looking at one paragraph every couple of days and trying to dissect it, trying to think about different ways to word it, try to figure out why the choices the writer made were made and why and how. And do that regularly, just a paragraph or a few sentences, and you'll actually see that things can transform pretty quickly. Just picking small bits of text on a regular basis and trying to really understand them the way you would something that was more of a hobby, right? Or you have to build something for your family. You're trying to understand the instructions. That's what I'd recommend.
Yeah. Well, Ross Guberman, thank you for joining us today. I think that's going to wrap up our episode for today, Jeff.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for being so generous with your time and insight, Ross. And for our audience, if you have suggestions for future episodes, please email us at info@calpodcast.com. In our upcoming episodes, look for tips on how to lay the groundwork for an appeal when preparing for trial.
See you next time.
You have just listened to the California Appellate Podcast, a discussion of timely trial tips and the latest cases and news coming from the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court. For more information about the cases discussed in today's episode, our hosts, and other episodes, visit the California Appellate Law Podcast website at calpodcast.com. That's calpodcast.com. Thanks to Jonathan Caro for our intro music. Thank you for listening, and please join us again.